everyone. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is Hashtag No Limits, and I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag No Limits is about people that society places limits upon, but who are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a better, more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those of you who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into its cells, then it has to reform into the butterfly in the chrysalis, in the cocoon, and then, as if that wasn't difficult enough, it has to struggle to get out of the cocoon in order for its wings to be strong enough to fly to take it wherever it's destined to go. And I think that is such a beautiful example, and I have seen that countless times in my teaching career, in my field as a master IEP coach, but even as Hashtag No Limits and my guests, and today is not going to be an exception, we are going to learn about the awesome Arish. Did I say it right?
Yep.
Okay. I had to think of my little acronym that I gave myself at the beginning. And he's going to tell us a lot about himself and what his life has been like and the limits that he has busted through. So Arish, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I think that's the first time I've ever heard my name said in an American accent. So it's very new to me.
Well, hopefully I did an okay job and it sounded nice. Okay, so for those of you who are listening and are watching, a couple of things. You now know that he's not an American, and I am, but also just some more to housekeeping things. If you're watching with us live, give us a hashtag live and let us know where you're from. If you're watching it in the replay, give us a hashtag replay and let us know where you're watching from. And I want to thank Arish because we just, at the airing of this in live stream format, this eventually will come out as a podcast, that we just changed our time from daylight savings or back to daylight savings. I never remember which season is called. But anyway, my time difference between where I am and where Arish is, it changed right after I sent him that this was the time we were supposed to meet. And so I appreciate you bearing with me through all of that. And for anyone who is watching live, thank you for catching us. If you're one of my normal viewers at this later time today. So Arish, as we said, you're not from the United States, and probably people have picked up on a little bit that you've said, but go ahead and tell us about yourself, where you're from, and all those fun details.
Yeah, sure. So my name is Arish. I am from London, England, born and raised. I am a solicitor or lawyer, as some people like to term it. And I'm registered blind. So I have a genetic condition called Stargardt's. It's a form of macular dystrophy, which means I have it's a genetic condition and I have no central vision. So the cells in the middle of my retina, the back of the eye, are dead, and that's sort of spreading. And yeah, the way I describe it for anyone who can't sort of imagine it is, if you look at a pizza and see a donut, that's pretty much how I see things. So there's always that bit missing in the middle. So whenever I'm looking around, I have to kind of look away from stuff to see it, which is, you know, a bit strange.
Right.
But yeah, otherwise, you know, I have lived pretty much all of my life. Well, I say, yeah, at this stage, it's pretty much most of my life, because it sort of started to develop around age maybe 10 or 11. So yeah, it's pretty much been there throughout all of secondary school, through all three universities, and through my entire career as a lawyer to date.
So I'm glad that you mentioned, because I was going to ask you, so you had quote unquote normal vision until a certain age then?
Yeah. Yeah. And strangely enough, I can't remember what that was like. So it's been so long that this is just what this is almost a default. And I sometimes forget that I can't see when people like say, oh, you know, they read a sign on like a billboard, as you'd call it, or like a bus number. And I'm like, I look at it and I realize, oh yeah, I can't read that. And I remember that I'm registered blind. But otherwise, because I've been going about my life for so long, I keep forgetting that, you know, I can't see things until it's pointed out to me.
Right. And so you had posted something on LinkedIn, just within the last couple of weeks, I think. And it was a picture of some devices that you had been using to help you since this has become your life. So for anybody that didn't see that or won't see that because they're just listening to this, describe what those were and what they were used for.
So they were a pair of binoculars, a telescope, and a handheld magnifying glass device, as it were. And basically, I went to school and did my first university stint at a time pre sort of smartphones and modern technology, late 90s, you know, noughties era. And so when my eyesight started to sort of go bad, there were no real technological apparatus in place to support me. So I literally had to use a pair of binoculars to look at the board and try and write down, you know, as many words at a time as I could before they were rubbed off the blackboard and then the whiteboard subsequently. And it wasn't until, you know, I think my second degree that I got an iPad and the smartphones came out and we could sort of take pictures or zoom into stuff and, you know, do all that kind of much more useful technology than just a telescope. But yeah, literally for my secondary education or high school, as it's termed in America, I literally had to learn everything off the board with just a pair of binoculars.
Wow. And so can you kind of remember, I know you don't remember not having the circle in the middle of everything, but can you kind of remember what you were feeling as you went from being able to see the blackboard and all of your friends and everything clearly? And then as it started, I'm presuming it was a slow transition, or did it just sort of happen overnight?
It sort of happened overnight. It was, so for the first sort of year of secondary school, high school, everything was normal. And then sort of over the summer holidays, again, things just seemed a bit blurry. But it wasn't until I came back for the start of year eight, which is the second year of secondary school, that I realized that I couldn't see the board. And even when I sort of gradually moved forward to the front of the class, I still couldn't see what was written on the board. And it was as if it had gone off a cliff edge. And so the thing is, I didn't immediately, acknowledge it. I kind of just tried to carry on and mask it and hide it, because I think going to a boys' school and going to such an elite academic school, you kind of don't want to show any weakness, and you always have to be top of the class and you always have to be getting 100% and getting everything right all the time. And it kind of felt like I had to keep that up. And in some ways, I'm glad that it was like that, because I always think, you know, that fed into my competitive nature. And if I wasn't competitive and wasn't in that environment, would I have crumbled and just, you know, not achieved anything? But yeah, it was my mum who actually picked it up when I didn't really want to do any of the activities that I usually do after school and at weekends. I love sports, and I couldn't play in the same way. So my mum kind of realized that I wasn't going to football or tennis or swimming or anything. So she kind of questioned it. And I think it became more obvious as I was holding paper and stuff like right up to my face that there's probably something wrong. So she was the one who kind of took me to the opticians. The opticians didn't really know what to make of it because they didn't have the technology or the apparatus to sort of take photos of the back of my eye. There's a specialist hospital in the UK called Moorfields Eye Hospital. It's a sort of renowned hospital specifically for the eyes. And they have, you know, all the machines and they can put the electrodes on your brain and do scans like that. And they can inject dye and take photos of your eye and stuff like that. It was only when I got those tests done that they figured out that there's this genetic condition and part of my eye is dead, as it were.
Yeah. Wow. And so you've come back, you've gotten these tests, you've now recognized, but how long did it take for you to accept that this was your new reality?
I still don't accept it in some way. I don't know if that's a good thing or bad thing. I've always been a person who's more interested in doing things than sitting around overly analyzing my emotional state. So I just, came back home and went on the Xbox or PlayStation, or just went to the garden and played football and had my homework, and the next day was back at school. So it wasn't really... there wasn't really much to consider. It was almost just finding a way to carry on. So, you know, if the end goal is to get good grades in the exams, then it doesn't really matter how you get to that end goal as long as you get there. So the fact that I had to use binoculars to look at the board was just another way of, you know, learning. So it didn't really faze me at all.
And how long did I'm just thinking, because it was such a new diagnosis, and, you know, even the way to diagnose is not everybody had that technology and that medical kind of equipment. So when you went back to school, here in the United States, we've had a law about special education and providing services since 1975. What is it like in the UK, and what was it like for you to get that service that you needed to be able to even use the binoculars or the magnifying glass or the telescope?
I mean, here the local council should be providing equipment and stuff like that. But at that time, it just wasn't great. And I think it was a relatively rare condition that I have. So there wasn't really much infrastructure in place at that time. Mm-hmm. And the school were, you know, supportive. They tried as best they could to sort of discuss it and find ways to help. But the reality was that it's almost like, because of the rate of academic learning, there was no sort of time for there to be any delays. You know, I had to sort of keep up. I had to be learning at the same pace as everyone else. And I guess I'm fortunate in that I've always found academics quite easy. So I didn't really struggle despite the visual impairment. It was more a case of everything else. So like sort of, you know, getting to and from school or crossing roads and playing sports, that kind of stuff was impacted. But academics, you know, the intake of information and the understanding and comprehension and interpretation, that was all unaffected by it. So I think I didn't suffer from the eyesight condition in terms of my academics. I think it did change my perspective, my attitude, but I don't think I suffered from it in any way.
That's incredible, because I mean, if I'm thinking of having a, you know, a donut and trying to read or trying to do a mathematics problem, that, you know, so much of the information is distorted and missing. And so I'm kind of thinking like having to tilt my head differently, or, you know, just like you said, just like holding the paper so close to your face and doing all the different other things besides just using the magnifying glass. And thinking of educators here in the United States, and, you know, that you were at school one day and maybe they had seen that you were struggling and having some difficulty when you hadn't the year before, but then you come in the day after and say, well, I have this vision issue. Now I need, you know, some assistance or whatever. And how did the kids respond? It sounds like the teachers responded quite well. It sounds like they were helpful.
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult because at the time I was like 11, 12 years old, something like that. So as a child, you know, you can't really comprehend the magnitude of it in the same way I can now as an adult. So looking back on how I reacted and how everyone reacted around me, I think to myself, you know, it's pretty crazy. And I think I didn't want to really acknowledge it myself. I just wanted to carry on and enjoy my life, basically, as it were. But yeah, I think that it's weird. It's almost, again, it's like my friends and the kids in school, it was almost like, I don't know, there was never any negativity around it. It was always, you know, everyone tried to help out. And if I couldn't see anything on the board and I asked people, they would write it down for me, or, you know, they'd give me their notes afterwards and stuff. I mean, there was also an element of fun and banter around it. Like if I put the telescope up, people would be like, "Arr," like a pirate noise, you know, looking through a telescope. So there was a lot of banter and that kind of stuff, which made it, you know, just more acceptable. But I think part of the, I guess one of the lucky elements that I had and still have, is that we're in an elite academic institution, one of the top, you know, top three schools in the UK historically. And so everyone who gets into that school is of a certain academic level. So when it comes to academia and the attitudes and aspirations around it, it's all sort of like, you know, we're all on the same level. We're all on similar levels. It's kind of like a, it's almost like there's a minimum that you'll achieve excellence and go on to top universities, etc. So there was no sort of special educational needs. There was no negative attitudes towards it, because at the end of the day, we're all there to basically be elite academics. So it was all kind of like the same culture, as it were.
That's awesome. I don't feel that that happens here in the United States, not in our public schools. Now, maybe, you know, in some of the upper echelon, more private type schools, if that was to happen, that could hopefully be somebody's experience. But I asked my questions because there is such a negative connotation here in the States about somebody who learns differently. And that's what I would say about you, is that you were still learning, but the way you had to go about it now was going to be different than what you had done before. And maybe what your peers were doing.
And I think, again, like the point you made, it is a caveat that my experience and my background is not the same experience that every other disabled person in the UK has, for sure. I mean, I've spoken to lots of people recently who have had, you know, terrible experiences of school. So I think, again, like I say, I was quite lucky in that respect, in the institution I was in and the people that were in that institution and the attitudes around education. But yeah, I mean, if I was in a different school, it could have been a different story.
Right. And so one of the things that when I advertised for your episode, we talked about the sports aspect. And I know that that has been something that has been, you know, things that you have focused on before. And we mentioned that a few minutes ago. So talk to me about that and how that changed for you and how you've had to adapt since you've had this really take over, not take over your life, but take over your vision.
Yeah. I mean, I still play football, or soccer, as Americans call it. And I've been playing since I was about 3 years old. So it's just natural to me. And it is impacted by the vision, because obviously a football field is huge. And, you know, right. I can't, you know, it's can't see half the stuff going on. But I think because when you do something from such a young age, you kind of pick up all the inherent traits of it and all the subtleties of it. So you kind of have an understanding of what's going on or what's supposed to be going on. So you can kind of figure it out. Our school, as a grammar school, we weren't allowed to play football. English grammar schools traditionally only play rugby. So I had to play rugby despite my condition, which was tough. I mean, I don't know if you know rugby very well. I know it's not that popular.
Not really.
It's basically like NFL, but it's kind of like that, but without pads and, you know, different rules, of course. But the concepts are similar, same shape ball and smashing into each other, etc. So there's,
all right, there's a lot. Well, that's basically that. How I understood it. So I guess I had a decent understanding then.
Yeah. So that was tough, because obviously judging speed and distance of someone trying to smash you is difficult when you can't see properly. But again, I think one of the things that I would say I'm grateful for is that I was kind of told that I had to play. I wasn't allowed to not play. If I had stopped playing and had been given sort of a way out or an excuse, then that could have shaped me differently. So the fact that I was almost told to kind of like carry on, you know, you're equivalent to everyone else, you're no different to anyone else, you know, all those factors, and also just the fact that, you know, you had to get on with it and you had to put yourself on the line, really, I think, built some resilience, but also not just from the visual perspective and the fear perspective, but also you know, from a life perspective, because there's going to be things you don't want to do in life. There's going to be things you have to do that you don't want to, you know, responsibilities, work, whatever there is. And I think if I had been let off as a child, I would maybe have gone down the route of, oh, this is a good excuse that I have built in that I can constantly use. So in some ways, I'm grateful that I was kind of forced to keep doing that. And then in more recent years, I have obviously still playing football, soccer. I've moved to other sports. So now I do bouldering or rock climbing, which is on my Instagram. And that's really fun because it's like sort of problem solving as well as the physical capacity of it. But I obviously have trouble when I either the holds are like spaced out or high up and I can't see them from the ground. So I can't plan or figure out the route until I'm on the wall, and which obviously right. you can make mistakes then. Or the color coordination is that some of the colors are so similar and all on the same wall that sometimes I get halfway up and I don't know where the next one is. And I'm asking my friends, like, is that one? Is that one? And it's like,
yeah,
it does get a bit frustrating. But I love it. And I think sports is my main passion, so I'll never give up playing anything because of this condition.
And that's, I think, fantastic, because so often I have heard team sports are an area where people who are learning differently thrive. And yep. there just seems to be a different type of camaraderie and welcoming and inclusive environment in many sports, not all. It's not been the experience of everyone that I've spoken to, but definitely a surprising number, honestly, because the part of the country in the U.S. where I'm from, we are very football heavy and very basketball, you know, high school sports are very big because we live in a rural area. So there's not a lot of other things to do. So you get competitive with the kids in your neighboring towns because you've played sports against them, you know, all of your primary years. And so, you know, to know that that option is out there, but it's so competitive, it surprises me in a lot of ways that it has been such a good environment for so many of the people that I know, former students and that sort of thing. And so I'm happy to hear that you've had positive experiences similar to ones that I know about here. What do you see for yourself in the future as far as, I mean, you kind of said it, you know, you're never going to give sports up, but do you see that you might have to play? I keep using the word "see." that you're going to maybe have to do it differently.
Potentially. I mean, this is another sort of attitudinal change I had when my eyesight went bad, and I kind of thought there's not much point in planning too far ahead because something like this can happen, and all your plans can go out the window. Something like COVID can happen. You know, anything can and happen. People get cancer, sadly, all the time, just randomly. I mean, I don't like to plan too far ahead because I think it's pointless. So as things stand, I can carry on with my sports. I can, you know, find other ways of doing them. I'll keep doing it until I can't. And then when I can't, I'll figure out a way to be able to do it again. So I think... And one thing we have here in the UK, I don't know if there is sort of the equivalent in the US, is that there is a large disability sports sector, and especially in London. I mean, that's one of the good things about being in London, the capital, is that we have everything you could ever want here. And so there are disability sports clubs for pretty much every single sport, which is sort of just disabled people, you know, specific disability teams, just getting the chance to participate in any sport they want. In a safe environment with people who understand, you know, disability and the needs of the disabled people. So I think, you know, if I can't carry on a mainstream, then I can shift across to that, or just find other sports. You know, there's end of the day, there's all sorts of stuff that potentially I love that's a lot less dangerous. I mean, I like pool and table tennis. I mean, there's no real impact or scared of getting hit in those. And, I can try and play them. And I can't see very well, so they're a bit tricky, but, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about the table tennis, like, how do you know where the ball is going?
Yeah, just to guess half the time, you know.
But But being sports minded, I bet that does actually help you, because I think your reflexes almost take over for you in some aspects. Like, you know, I can see it on the other end. And so it's probably going to be, and then your hand just kind of naturally goes to where you think it might go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, anticipation and, you know, just natural instinct is also a large part of any sport, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that's why I'm not good at sports.
Fair enough.
I always, you know, say, like, with crafts and sports, you know, they're not as great unless you have people to watch and appreciate. And that's me. That's my role. You all can do it and I'll appreciate it and I'll watch it.
Everyone loves an audience. It's not the same thing with your mates in the park. You need to have people to cheer or boo, you know?
Yeah, I think it does. It motivates you and gets some high energy going a lot of times. And you know, especially if you're not doing well and you've got that whole cheering squad, like, come on, you can do it. We know you can do it. But
yeah,
it gives you a bit of motivation. So being a solicitor, what is the process like in the UK to become a solicitor?
So the route I took is the, I guess the most, conventional route is that you do a law degree, and then with that law degree, you can then do the, relevant qualifications to either become a solicitor or a barrister. So in my case, I did the LPC, which is the legal practice course, and that is the course to become a solicitor. And then when you finish that, you have to do a training contract, which is usually 2 years. And then once you've completed your training contract, you then qualify as a solicitor. There is an alternative route where you can do any degree, and then you can do a law conversion called the GDL, Graduate Diploma in Law. And then you do the LPC, and then you do your training contract, and then you qualify. If you want to be a barrister after your law degree, there is a different course. It's the bar course. You have to do that to become a barrister. And then you also have to do pupillages and get residency at chambers and all kinds of stuff. So it's also another complex route. There are also other methods. So there's a Chartered Legal Executives, Silex it's called. That's another route to qualifying as a practicing professional, although you're not technically a solicitor, you're a Silex qualified. And recently they're introducing a new qualification. I think it's called SQE, maybe. I don't know, to be honest. I did mine about, 6-7 years ago now, so I was way before that. Okay. But I think there is also another route now. There's a fair amount of academics and then workplace training, and then you qualify.
And with all of those different steps, what sort of challenges, or were there any challenges that you had to figure out how to maneuver through?
Yes, but ironically not. Well, I was going to say not disability related, but yeah, also kind of disability related. So when I did my law degree, because it's all text-based, I could just read it on my own computer, on my screen, at my own pace, which was great because then I could just do it all myself. So the law degree was pretty straightforward. The LPC, again, was just all sort of text-based academic learning. So again, I could just do that all myself. Getting a training contract is one of the hardest things for LPC graduates because it's so competitive. There are so many, you know, applicants going for so few roles. And also a lot of law firms take their candidates 2 years in advance. So you also have to know about that and apply, you know, in good time. Okay. Then you also have from the date of your LPC, from getting your LPC, you have 6 years to, I think it's either 6 years to qualify. And if you don't qualify in 6 years, your LPC gets timed out and you have to do it again. And the LPC costs £15,000. Oh, wow. So if you get timed out, you have to spend another 15K to, you know, and I think in dollars, it's probably like, it's not one to two right now. I don't know what, 20, 25,000.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pressure on that. But what I found was when I went to interviews for training contracts, because of the school I'd gone to, I got quite a few interviews quite easily, and people were interested in talking to me about the school I went to. And so I didn't have any trouble finding a training contract. And I actually didn't even know about the 2 years in advance thing. And I just sort of sent out my CV, just bombarded random firms as many as I could, and just had multiple interviews. So I was very lucky in that sense. And my disability was seen as something that I'd overcome, and it was amazing and blah, blah, blah. So that was all fine as well. The training contract was really good. I trained at a sort of top tier Lincoln's Inn practice. And Lincoln's Inn is one of the four inns of court in the UK where barristers are called to the bar. And Lincoln's Inn is kind of like a spiritual home of law almost. It's
okay.
Behind the Law Society on Chancery Lane. So it's one of the oldest legal establishments, you know, in English history. So again, I trained at a top tier practice. But what sort of the main struggle I've had, the main problem I've had, is post qualification, when I've actually become a qualified practicing solicitor and I can start charging big money and making money for the firms and all that kind of stuff, everywhere I went to interview for, as soon as I mentioned my disability, it kind of just went dead. So It seemed to me like now it is a barrier. Now people think, oh, how can you do that? Like, people ask me questions like, can you read? And it's like, well, obviously I can read. You know, I'm not illiterate. How would I be a solicitor if I couldn't read?
Right.
And so it was very strange to me. And it's only been to the last few years the last 5 years really, of working in the legal sector that I've kind of noticed so many attitudinal barriers when it comes to disability. And it's not treated with the same importance as, for example, race and gender and sexuality and that kind of stuff, which come way higher on the equality and diversity list than disability does, which is what has fueled me to start my own podcast and try and do my own disability advocacy to maybe spread some awareness and try and, you know, make some kind of impactful change. But, you know, whether that will happen or not remains to be seen. But I think there is a, I don't want to say stigma, but there is an attitude in law that, because law in the UK, especially at the top tier firms, is ruthless. It's kind of just all about how much you can bill and how many billable hours a day you're doing and your monthly targets and your annual targets. And if you're not hitting all of those or going above them, then you can kind of get cut, you know, pretty easily. So it's very ruthless. It's kind of like what you see in the films, you know, big American films.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's pretty similar here. And that doesn't lend to disability, because disabled people, you know, reasonable adjustments mean that they might require more different equipment, more time, different ways of working, all of which don't lend to the traditional method in law of just churning out billable hours and invoices and that kind of stuff. So I think there is a big mismatch with disability and the way the legal profession works in this country at the moment. So that's something I'm trying to highlight and, you know, hopefully make some kind of change in.
Yeah, and kudos to you for doing that. That's kind of also the reason that I started #NoLimits 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, because having been an educator, and then I wrote a book, and in the book, I interviewed 9 different families that have a member who is disabled or was eligible for special education in some capacity. And there's a few chapters where the person themselves was willing to share their stories with me. And to hear about their experiences in the medical world, experiences with their families, experiences in education, it was shocking in a way to me. But there was a part of me that I had an idea already. I just didn't have the idea to the magnitude of what the families actually go through or what the individual goes through. And I thought, you know, I could write more books, but I might have a bigger and a quicker impact if I shared people's or had them share their own stories on this. Because I think that perspective and having that understanding that different isn't bad, and to make a few accommodations or to look at things a little bit differently, that enhances all of us. And to try, and that happened to me, honestly. I mean, when I was growing up, I didn't want to teach special education. I wanted to teach general education. And it was because I didn't have a good perspective. I didn't have enough exposure to someone who would be found eligible for special education. But when I started realizing the different situations and jobs that I was in, that I had lots of people in those situations that would be eligible for special education or were considered disabled in whatever way, I thought, there somebody who has a disability or is eligible for special education isn't less than I am. They're not less worthy. They're, you know, they're just as valuable. And I think because of that, for me, that's what I hope comes out of doing this, is that other people will tune in and go, here you have, a lawyer who's gone through lots of and the high pressure situations, and, they're extremely successful, in your life. And that was a lot of what I heard as a teacher and from some of the families in the book, were that people looked at them as though they would never be successful. They would never have a happy life. They would never go to college. They would never go on a nice vacation. I mean, just all these strange ideas.
Yeah. I mean, there was, I don't know if there still is, there probably still is, there was negative connotations and stigma around terms like special educational needs or special needs. I remember growing up, there was a lot of, mocking of that kind of stuff. And if you think about sort of, I always think that, like you say, perspectives are important. And I think people, my conclusion is that people don't have certain perspectives because they've never experienced them. And that can be, that's fair enough. I mean, if you've never come across someone who's registered blind, then how would you have that perspective? That's not, that's not their fault. There's nothing, they're not intentionally or maliciously trying to, degrade anyone. They just don't know. And so in those scenarios, it's fine because you can just educate them and they can understand and learn new perspectives and think differently. And I've never come across a situation where people have not wanted to learn or, understand. So all my experiences to date have been, if not initially positive, eventually positive. So right. I've never experienced any real negativity or hindrance in my life, despite my disability. My main issues are with my own frustration of not being able to maximize my potential, because at the end of the day, no matter how much technology I have or how supportive people are, I can't regrow the cells that are dead in my eye. So I will not be able to see properly ever, regardless of, like I said, all those other things. So that is factually inherently a limiting factor. And that really sort of grates on me with everything I do. And obviously, we try to accept things in life and, always try and stay positive, but it is hard. It is hard to not get annoyed. It is hard to not get frustrated. I mean, I recently, just out of boredom, I decided to order the Mensa home test, just because I thought, it was going to be a challenge. It'd be fun. And the home test is sort of an indicative test. You do it, it's timed 45 minutes, 10 questions. If you do it, you send it in, they mark it, and they say your IQ is X and you're in the top whatever percent and you should come in and do the real thing. So it's a 45-minute test, 10 questions. I did it in about 20 minutes, and it said, you won't answer all of them, you won't get them all correct. And when I did it, in one of the questions, I couldn't even see it properly because it was a color-coded thing, and I was like, I don't even know what these colors are, I can't really tell. But I thought, at the end, this is so easy, this can't be a real test. I mean, it's like I did more than this when I was a kid, this is rubbish. I thought I was going to, have some kind of challenge. Sent it in, my own generic... My base level is to be very self arrogant, as it were. And it came back saying IQ 155, top 99.9% of the country, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, that wasn't even a challenge, and I couldn't see one of the questions, and I still got this. I mean, it's just like,
right.
And so I think to myself, my friends even say to me, some of my friends said, like, you know, you should have been in NASA. And it's like, yeah, I should have been a lot of things, but you know, there's this inbuilt mechanism, which means I can't see properly. So I can't do things. And that just, I don't want to swear, but it really annoys me. It really annoys me every day with everything I do. That's if I'm being honest, that is the main problem that I have with my vision. It's nothing else. There's nothing I've stopped doing because of my eyes. There's nothing I can't really do. I just find another way. It's the fact that I can't do everything to the best of my potential. And anyone who has ever done anything they loved will know that if you can't then do it properly, you're just not happy.
Right. You almost don't even want to try sometimes because if I can't do it to my best, then why do it at all?
Exactly.
Yeah. And I have a tiny bit of understanding of that because I've had people tell me that, you know, I give 150%, which obviously is not possible, but you know, whenever I think I have done something poorly because I haven't given it every bit of energy and effort that I feel I could have, it still oftentimes gets complimented and, you know, nice reviews and, you know, I never would have done it that well. And here I'm thinking, but I didn't even do my best on that. And yeah. And so I kind of understand what you're talking about. I don't have a frustration, but it's trying to accept and have that balance of it's okay to be who I am. Who I am is better than okay. It's actually, I'm a wonderful person and what I can do is fabulous. And to try not to add that, but, you know, like you're saying, and I so appreciate your honesty with this because I think that's an area that doesn't get brought out very often is, you know, it might be frustrating for someone who's dealing with you and trying to make accommodations or trying to understand, you know, the disability and how it works and, you know, all of that sort of thing. But I'm not living with it 24/7. And I don't have to feel those stifling moments that you feel. And you definitely, I mean, in talking with you, talking about the elite school that you went to and the, you know, the elite law firms and all of these, you know, you are definitely a high achiever. And I can only imagine what it must feel like for you daily and even moment to moment sometimes. So I really appreciate that you brought that out.
No, I interestingly, I don't have any reservations about talking about, you know, my condition or how it makes me feel, or, you know, what I, you know, I it is what it is. And, you know, what I find interesting about a lot of people is they, especially, I don't know if it's the same in the US, but in the UK, there's a very much a sort of, there's an identity around disability. So disability, mm-hmm. So people say to, you know, people ask the question of, you know, if you could like fix your disability or magic wand and not have it, would you do that? And people often say, no, you know, it's part of who I am. But for me personally, and I don't know if it's going to be an unpopular view or whatever, it's just my view. I would fix it immediately. You know, I'm not proud of not being able to see. It's not something I carry like a beacon of great hope or whatever. It's inconvenient. Right. It's annoying. It's useless. How does me not be able to see any positive in my life? You know, it doesn't help me in any way. But it's, you know, it's there. It, you know, I can't escape it. I can never escape it, unfortunately. so I just have to kind of live with it. And yes, I have to accept it. And I have to accept that this sort of limited version of me is me because of that. And that is who I am. And that is my disability and whatever. But, you know, being a naturally competitive person, being someone who grew up playing sports and still plays sports, you know, went to an elite school, I'm very competitive. And if I know that, you know, and everything I've achieved is pretty much, well, I don't want to say the best I could have done because it's not the best I could do. It's way short of the best I could do because I can't see. So that's what annoys me, you know, and it always will annoy me. And I don't think I'll ever be one of these people. I kind of envy people who are like, you know, at peace and zen with what they are, and you know, because I know for a fact I would never be satisfied knowing that I could always potentially do more, but have this limiting factor. I won't be satisfied. I mean, that's just, you know, the honesty of it.
Right. And that's got to be a tiring way to live, honestly.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's exhausting. But the flip side of that is to resign myself to being a limited, reduced version of my true self, which I don't want to do. So I'd rather carry the weight of frustration than settle for mediocrity.
Sure. I understand that. So you do have a website, and you, like you mentioned before, you have your own podcast. So tell me now about, you know, you have had difficulty sometimes getting positions because of the disability. And so therefore, you know, you've kind of, and you've had an attitude change, you said, once you became someone with a disability. So talk about, you know, the website, your podcast, and I'm going to, if it's okay, pop up the website while you're talking.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So it's called Disability Platform. It's disabilityplatform.co.uk. And I set it up because I thought to myself, if I, with my background, struggle sometimes to find work or to excel because of my disability, there must be many other disabled people out there who either don't have my background or haven't got my experience. So, you know, they would probably struggle as well. And I kind of don't want the younger generation to have to go through the same situations or have to overcome the same barriers that I did, when, you know, I can simply try and help, you know, to overcome some of that stuff. So I was kind of trying to make it into, a resource, basically, where at the moment I'm speaking to different individuals. So the first episode is up, and it's on YouTube, and it's on Spotify and Amazon and Apple and all that kind of stuff. And it's with an interview with a guy called Isaac Harvey, MBE. So he has been recognized by the Crown for his amazing charity work and his advocacy. And he has a condition called limp pelvic hypoplasia, which means he was born without any arms. And I think he has very short legs and feet. So he's wheelchair bound. And he's just amazing. I mean, he, you know, is a disability advocate. He champions disability. He tries to make social change. He's always talking and sharing. And I mean, he even goes skiing, which for someone with no arms and only a torso and feet is pretty incredible. And there's a video about halfway through the episode which shows him skiing, and it's incredible to see how happy and how content he is with his life despite his condition, which I think is inspirational. And also, you know, the fact that he also is a video editor, videographer, content creator. He does all of that stuff, again, despite his disability. So he's found ways to be productive and happy and live a full life. So that's the first episode. And I have some future episodes lined up. I have the recordings already ready to go. And one of the key aims of the podcast is to speak to different people in different professions. So I've got a barrister who actually has the same condition as I do. So she has Stargardt's. So she also is registered blind. She's a barrister, so she goes to court and argues and all that kind of stuff. There's other people as well. And what the aim is to speak to disabled people within different professions to kind of highlight some of their challenges or barriers that they have faced or issues that they can identify within that profession or that industry, so that the younger generation sort of coming through can potentially get an insight into careers, or maybe it will open up different avenues they didn't think about. Because personally for me, I didn't have any disabled people to speak to when I was in school or in uni, sort of to get real life perspective of what the actual working world is like for disabled people. And I just went through mainstream and, you know, all the people that I spoke to and gave me advice weren't disabled, and they just, you know, gave me advice, which I wouldn't say was wrong. It just wasn't really relevant. And because I didn't know any better and I didn't know who else to speak to, I just took that advice. And I would have definitely made different choices if I had had advice from different, from disabled people, you know, in different professions. And so that's what I kind of want to do, is to give the younger generation more resources and more of a platform to kind of build their life in the way that they want, and to not have avenues cut off when really they shouldn't be.
Right. That's fantastic. And so the ways that people can find you is if they go to your website. I saw you had your little icons for X, Instagram, LinkedIn, and then YouTube. Yeah. I think that is very similar to what this is. It sounds like.
Yeah, definitely.
And so good luck to you for that. I did catch a brief few minutes of your first episode. I watched it a little bit on YouTube. I was thinking, maybe I need to have Arash give me some connections because, you know, again, we're talking to basically, you know, very similar types of guests. And I'd love to showcase. You're the third or fourth person I've had from the UK. And I think we might be connected on LinkedIn to one of them together, Mark Webb. Is that someone's name, you know?
Yeah.
And then Victoria Jenkins and and I'm trying to think. I think, like I said, I think you're the third. Hope you're not the fourth and I'm forgetting somebody. It's not intentional if I've forgotten you, whoever you might be. I'm sorry.
What would be really interesting is to have you on my podcast, because then we can talk about the attitudes and the infrastructure for disabled people, you know, your perspective from America and my experiences in the UK, and see, you know, where the parallels and differences are there. There's probably a lot to learn for both countries.
Oh yeah, I'm sure. I mean, there are things that we do very well here in the United States, but there are things that other parts of the world do much better.
And likewise.
Yeah, it's always interesting. I've had some people from Australia on as well. And so to hear how they do things there and, just to learn about the different ways and the different possibilities. And one of the great things that I have found with #NoLimits is I have myself had my own eyes opened to things that I didn't think were possible. I will have some guests on soon that are playing. It's a sport called goal ball. Yep. And so you know about that sport?
I do, yes. Being registered blind, I'm familiar with goal ball.
Yeah. And then we have blind hockey and blind baseball here in the United States. And I've had members from both of those other organizations on. And that was not something that was a limit that I had placed. And that's kind of the idea of the show. It's not necessarily that you're physically placing limits on people, but it's the mentality of this is as far as somebody can go. Yeah. And so, you know, to hear you talk about rock climbing or bouldering, as you called it, you know, and that you're playing football or rugby and or soccer, whichever, you know, any and all of the above, again, those are things that people just automatically think, oh, well, they can't see, they can't do this. And, you know, I've seen technological advances for people who are, you know, wheelchair users, and Mark Webb actually corrected me one time because I said wheelchair bound and he's like, you're not leg bound. I'm not wheelchair bound. Like, oh, okay. Fair that's enough. A good point. you know, and so just learning about all the possibilities of things that are out there and having that hope that maybe if something isn't happening right now, it could happen in the future because the technology might advance. The medical breakthroughs might happen. The scientific breakthroughs could happen. Some parent or loved one of somebody who's unable to do something because there isn't a device or a service out there is going to make something in order for that to happen. And, you know, miracles that could happen. And so I love doing this because I get to see so many things that the typical person doesn't have any knowledge of. And I hope that you will find that for yourself as well in your own podcast that, you know, things that you never thought of either. And maybe you'll find you've yourself set limits on some people that you didn't think about.
Probably. I mean, subconsciously, we all kind of do, don't we? I mean, unless we know different, we just take our first instinctive reaction to something to be all we know. So unless, right. you know, and that's what I was trying to get at before about the point that I've never come across anyone who's sort of malicious about it. It's more a case mm-hmm. of literally just never having come across something. So I think this podcast, you know, trying to highlight the no limits mentality is amazing. And I'm glad to be on as a guest.
Well, and we have to wrap up. It's already close to an hour. And wow, and so okay. thank you for being here. But I do want to give you opportunity. If there was something you wanted to talk about, we've got about 4 minutes before we really have to, before I like to dead stop. So is there anything that you had hoped to share that you haven't shared already?
To be honest, not that I can think of off the top of my head, but I think the main thing that I always try to impart is the same thing that your whole podcast is about. You know, there are no real limits if everyone wants to sort of get on board with something. I mean, you know, COVID changed the world and the way we work and live. Everyone stopped for a while and then found different ways of surviving and carrying on. And disability, you know, it can be daunting and scary for people who experience it, who become disabled or who are born disabled, who face attitudinal societal barriers. But again, at the end of the day, we're all people and everyone can collaborate to find a way to move forward.
Yeah, I believe that very much. And I thank you for saying that. And again, Arash, thank you for being my guest today. And yeah, if you want to have me on Disability Podcast, I'd be happy to hop on with you sometime and Definitely. We'll have to arrange that. For everyone else, thank you for joining in today. And thank you for anyone who's going to watch in the replay. Make sure if you have any questions, you put them in the chat. I will make sure to get them to Arash, or if it's something for me, that I will answer it. And tune in next week. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.